Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Today we will talk about what happened in the recent elections, what it means for us and our country, and what progressives can do going forward. Here to help us analyze what happened and what we can do is Heather Booth, one of the leading progressive strategists in the United States. Heather has been an organizer for over 40 years, starting in the civil rights and women's movements. She was the founding director and is now president of the Midwest Academy, a leading center that trains social change leaders and organizers. She's been involved in and managed many political campaigns and was the training director of the Democratic National Committee. In 2000, she was the director of the NAACP National Voter Fund, which helped increase African-American election turnout by nearly 2 million voters. She has been a consultant to many social change and political groups, including MoveOn.org, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, and the National Council of La Raza. She was the lead consultant directing the founding of the Campaign for Comprehensive Immigration Reform. In 2009, she directed the campaign passing President Obama's first budget. In 2010, she was the founding director of Americans for Financial Reform, fighting to regulate the financial industry. She was the national coordinator for recent events around marriage equality across the United States. She is now consulting with the Voter Participation Center and is advisor to the Alliance for Citizenship, a coalition of immigration reform. She has been a board member and executive committee member of U.S. Action since its founding and a board member of the Center for Community Change. She is a partner in Democracy Partners. She's earned both a bachelor's and master's degree from the University of Chicago. I am delighted to welcome today Heather Booth. Heather, welcome to All Together Now.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be on a show called All Together Now, because I actually think that's the nature of our problem, was that we didn't project that we were all together now, that we were all in it together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way out of the dilemmas we face is to show that we are all in it together. I also, Eleanor, wanted to thank you. You're really such a delight. You promote such wonderful progressive human values and live those values. So it's wonderful to be with you, even if through the radio.
Wonderful. I really appreciate that. Thank you, Heather. Today we have some breaking news about Elizabeth Warren. So we're going to circle back to that a little bit later in the show. But let's first talk about what happened in the election. You know, we're, I think, still feeling a bit of the shock of how bad it was last Tuesday with Democrats losing the majority in the Senate, more seats in the House, losing governorships, and even the normally Democratic states of Maryland, Massachusetts, and Illinois. What is your take about why the Democrats lost so badly last week?
Well, certainly for those of us who care about building a better society, it's a very difficult election, and we are going to live with the results of it for quite some time in very difficult ways. And while there are many reasons for the results, I think that the main message is that we need to believe, promote, and live our values. It's what we know is right, and the polls tell us even the American public supports, and broadly, that we need to send out a message that we are all in it together for an economy that works for all of us and not just the wealthiest few. We need to develop and promote a sharp vision of economic equality and greater opportunity for those who are left out of the recovery from when Wall Street crashed the economy and left the rest of us behind. And that, by the way, was the finding of several polls, even on election night, including one by the AFL-CIO.
Really? That it was, the key was about the economy?
The key was about the economy and speaking for the vast majority of us who are struggling to get by, and also about who caused the problem, that Wall Street caused the problem, and the wealthiest few, they're doing just fine. But what about the rest of us? When you look at all the reality of people's lives, you know, right now we're told that there's been solid job growth, and there has been. There's incredible Wall Street profit, but there's terrible weak wage growth.
Uh-huh.
We're falling behind. In fact, the median inflation last year was still $2,100 lower for the average family than when President Obama took office in 2000.
Mm.
And it was $3,600 lower than when George Bush took office in 2001.
Mm.
So people's lives, it's not just a message issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's a people's own reality. The AFL-CIO exit polling had some interesting figures also that indicate this is a way out of indicating how we are all in it together. 54% of voters say that they had suffered a decline in household income in the last year. 33% thought they were just staying even.
Mm.
63% thought the economy was fundamentally unfair. And 55% strongly agreed, and another 25% somewhat agreed, that both parties were too focused on helping Wall Street and not enough about helping ordinary people. So the point is that people's lives, their reality, was telling them something's not really working for them, and they were looking to see who was on their side.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good analysis. So you're really feeling it was and looking at the data showing that people are concerned about their economic situation and it's not moving. I think there was perhaps a misstep with the White House in the middle of the election talking about the improving economy, which, you know, yes, the indicators were showing, you know, some growth. As you mentioned, the jobs have improved. But what that failed to recognize is the reality that 95% of the growth since the 2008 recession has gone to the top 1%.
Mm-hmm.
So the indicators may look good, but the top 1% maybe never had it as good as they do now. But the other, the rest of everybody else is looking and going, none of those crumbs are coming down to me. You know, we're still struggling here on Main Street.
Mm-hmm. I tried to find out after the election, what was it that were in the candidate ads, the things that people saw on TV, and who spoke to them about their lives. And there was a YouGov survey of what voters remembered from candidate ads. Most remembered Republicans talking about a poor economy with people falling behind, not being able to keep up. Though then the Republicans blamed it on the president and Obama or a government that was taxing you. And we would have different solutions. But the Democrats often ran on distancing themselves from mm-hmm. from Obama, from the government, from particular issues. But those issues were of concern to most people. And they were also fractured issues in the ways that so many of the Democrats presented it. I'm just talking about one particular issue and not broadly about raising up the vast majority of working families who are struggling to get ahead and for whom we do have some solutions. And, you know, you can further see that there is support on the issues because where progressive issues were up as ballot measures, they basically won.
Right. Every one of the moves on the referenda for increasing the minimum wage won in red states and blue.
Right. And in 5 out of 5 states where they ran, in Arkansas, Alaska, Nebraska, South Dakota, they won on raising the minimum wage. In 4 out of 4 states that had ballot measures on paid sick days, all of Massachusetts, Trenton, New Jersey, Montclair, New Jersey, Oakland, California, again, paid sick days won. In California, a prison reform won that was called Safe Neighborhoods and Safe Schools, but it will revise low-level petty crimes from being treated as felonies and treat them instead as misdemeanors.
Mm.
And there's even a longer list. In Colorado and North Dakota, they defeated proposals granting personhood to fetuses at the moment of conception. Planned Parenthood played a very important role, as did a number of other groups. Even gun control advocates won in Colorado at the state level on state-level candidates. And the list goes on. So it's not that the public didn't agree on these particular issues and more.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't enough, and especially if only done during election time, to say, we care about working families. We recognize that Wall Street crashed the economy and the top 1% is making off like bandits. We need to do something about that, but even more, we need to do those things that will raise up working families. By the way, even on the phrase working families, I found this interesting. There's some polling that says the term middle class is now a less popular term. It's not that it's unpopular, it's still effective. But it's less popular because it sounds more secure.
Wow.
And people don't feel secure in a secure middle class.
Mm-hmm.
They feel insecure as working families. While some are doing very well, we're falling behind and we can't keep up.
Right. That is fascinating. Well, I think, you know, we just look at the economic disaster that George W. Bush left in his wake. And, you know, millions of people losing their homes or going underwater in their homes, owing more in their mortgages than their homes were worth. Literally trillions of dollars of wealth from mm-hmm. people and their home ownership, and if they did own any stocks, you know, the crash that came then. But the home is where most of us in the middle class had, so that what we're seeing now is that dramatic class slippage, that people who had been securely in the middle class are now, you know, falling down, and they're way less secure.
Mm-hmm.
They don't own the home anymore. They're renting someone else's property, paying someone else's mortgage. They don't have that asset. For millions of people, the job insecurity is there. The ability to pay for education for our kids is in jeopardy. And then you've got the interest rates for the students
mm-hmm.
coming out, as we've got now a whole generation of really indentured servitude. The students coming out, they may have a college degree, but they've got a noose around their neck with having to pay back the loans, and there's no chance of having that ever forgiven. So that's really kind of very shocking what you say, but understandable given what's happened with the economy since 2008 in particular.
And that it's particularly sad, since people do care about these issues, but it's beyond issues. People want to know, is there a broad, is there policy, is there organizing, is there consistency behind a message that talks about raising up people's standard of living? And many candidates didn't run on this overall message of that we're in it all together now,
mm-hmm.
that we can make an economy work for all of us. Where there was a translation to Democratic candidates, many of them were successful. Jeff Merkley in Oregon never backed away from supporting Obamacare. But he won in Oregon for the Senate by percentage points more than Obama won when Obama won the state in 2012.
Interesting.
Or Al Franken in Minnesota, he won fighting Wall Street and won by a larger margin than Obama won in Minnesota in 2012 also. And there are some other examples, some from states that were somewhat easier. Jerry Brown in California, which has become, since the big fight on immigration reform, which has now changed that to a more solidly blue state. Jerry Brown won in California supporting a millionaire's tax that was dedicated to funding public schools. Or Dan Malloy, the governor of Connecticut, he won after he raised taxes so he could invest in education. And he passed earned sick days as well as a minimum wage hike. And yet there were other places, for example, in Kentucky, where Obamacare, over 400,000 people in Kentucky have signed up for Obamacare. It's a significant success, but it wasn't treated as a positive campaign issue, even though the governor, Beshear, a Democrat, has wide popularity, and he won support championing the benefits of Obamacare in the state. So part of what we're seeing is, well, many fine people, fine candidates, ran talking about particular sections of issues. There was no big story told about how people are falling behind with a bigger vision of what we can do to raise up their lives and actually have policies that support them. And I think those are also things that need to be done not just during election time, but being done as a whole campaign, year in, year out. And we can start doing it now, at least for the next 2 years, and even beyond that.
I think that's excellent. I hope that is exactly the direction the Democratic Party goes. I'm a little concerned in the wake of the results here that some people might get the wrong lesson from this election and think, oh, well, the country's turning right, so we better turn to the right, too. You know, in my experience, as they say, whenever you run a Republican against a Republican, the Republican will win every time. I mean, we've really got to draw a distinction, and I love what you're saying about create a narrative that describes the experience people know is true in their own lives with a specific plan of action of how we can raise people up. So I hope that's the narrative that wins in the debate within the Democratic Party now.
Your concern about Democrats thinking maybe we have to move more to the center, so-called, as opposed to, this isn't really about center or not center. It's about, are we moving to people and their lives? Now, the Republicans understand this message. That's why, as I said, many of the ads people recalled were Republicans talking about this. But if there is an attempt by Democrats, there's been some discussion about should Democrats have this grand bargain on taxes, on cutting Social Security. If we fall for that, if there's a fight on those terms, the right wing, the right wing Republicans know that that is a doom direction for Democrats and certainly for progressives. Karl Rove and his PAC, Crossroads GPS, which was one of the biggest players in the election, ran ads against Democrats who had supported a plan to raise the retirement age, cut the cost of living adjustments in Social Security, and undercut the benefits for younger workers. That was some of the language in the ads. And the reason he could run those ads, and they weren't taken off the air as saying, well, there's no truth to that, because after who's really defended Social Security, it's more likely been the Democrats. But it's because there was an attempt by some Democrats to cut Social Security when they were looking for this grand bargain, because some were so concerned about the deficit, which, as we know, is going down, and also when you're coming out of a recession still and people's lives haven't recovered, that's not the time to look to cut people's standard of living at all, and especially Social Security. If there's one point of universal agreement in the United States, it is that Social Security needs to be strengthened and not weakened. And so Karl Rove understood that, even if some of the Democrats didn't hear that.
Very interesting. You know, let's look at some of the other issues at play. I think you're spot on in terms of the messaging problem and also about Democrats, you know, running from the president, no more obviously than the Senate candidate in Kentucky who wouldn't even admit that she voted for Obama for president. And she had been neck and neck with Mitch McConnell for the U.S. Senate seat in Kentucky until that moment, and then it's like all the air went out of the balloon. But what about some of the other issues that, you know, some of us have been concerned about for years? I know you've put tremendous good work into voter turnout, and we know voter turnout is always lower in elections when the president's not on the ballot. But this year, the voter turnout nationwide was even lower than the last midterm. And what about the voter suppression efforts? This
right.
is the first election we've had without the voting rights protecting the right of citizens to vote. Do you have any sense of how widespread was voter suppression or the numbers of people who
right.
might have been taken off the voting rolls or turned away when they showed up? Have you tracked that at all?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're absolutely right that we had the worst voter turnout in 72 years. Now, you always have lower turnout in a midterm versus a presidential election because presidential election, all states are involved. One of the things about a midterm is that states where there are less competitive races, where much of the population is, and much of the people of color population is, California, Texas, New York, those three largest states, only a third of eligible voters turned out because there weren't, by the time you got to the election, there weren't big contests that seemed close. And so you always have lower turnout in a midterm election. But in 43 states, less than half the eligible population came out to vote, and no state even reached 60% in turnout. And the people who are least likely to turn out, and this has been always true, are what we call the rising American electorate, African Americans, Latinos, young people, and unmarried women. And the reason they turn out, these populations, in far lower numbers and percentages than they are in the general population. So they're really underrepresented. And it's also true, these are populations, people of color, young people, unmarried women, who are among the more tolerant and diverse parts of the population, understanding more that we really can succeed more likely when we're in it together. But they either are too busy or didn't see a stake for themselves in these races. And it's doubly magnified because many of the people of color populations, especially Latinos, are a very young population. And we know young voters turn out far less than other voters. Now, there were issues that were particularly being pushed, some of the ballot measures, that were designed to attract many of these voters. But if you just start to go through the issues, the National Partnership on Women and Families analyzed candidate websites and found that only 23% of candidates featured their positions on fair or equal pay for women, paid sick days, paid family and medical leave, or pregnancy discrimination on their websites. And those who did were more likely to win, 8% more likely to win than those who didn't. So again, it's the issue of, if you don't talk about what's of concern to people and you're not relating to people's lives, why should people come out? Especially when you're competing against such enormous amounts of money in the process with other ads that are drowning out not only a more progressive message, but are also designed to discourage people to vote.
Right, and even with the ads, if they weren't explicitly meant to get people not to vote, it's just so overwhelming now, the amount of money that's there, the amount of ads that there are. I'm one of the most political aware and active people in the country. And
you certainly are.
I reached a point I was like, please, no more phone calls. I went out one day, came back, I had 12 phone messages from various candidates and asking to make calls for this and that. And if I'm feeling that way, I can only imagine people who are kind of more tangentially engaged in political affairs and activities. And so much of it is negative ads attacking the other guy, because as we know, it's a lot easier to drive up the negative of the opponent than it is to persuade people that you're trustworthy and a good candidate. It's way easier to attack the other guy and raise the doubts and fears about somebody else. So we just saw hundreds of millions of dollars yet again spent in an election to say how bad the other guy was. So I get, you know, in that sense, long term, I'm concerned about the level of civic engagement of a population where we are bombarded every 2 years with that level of negativity. And then we wonder why people don't have confidence in government or feel excited about elections.
You know, on what you said, it's so true. $4 billion of money that we can track was spent in this last election.
$4 billion in a midterm.
In a midterm election, much of it spent, probably most of it spent, from third-party organizations, because since the Supreme Court, Citizens United decisions, and other decisions, they basically said, if you've got money, use it as much as you want, because money is speech, and we can't limit your money speech. Whereas the average person, without the millions or billions of dollars behind their voice, or the candidates without that kind of money behind their voice, do get drowned out. And further, you also touched on this issue of, by the way, the money in politics is one of the reasons that raising issues about money in politics is so important.
Mm-hmm.
And every issue, because it also ties in with who caused the problem. So any issue that you're working on, to tie it into saying, you know, we want an economy that works for all and not just for the wealthiest few, those who are advancing a fracking proposal, an anti-environmental proposal, in order to support their own personal and corporate interests, as the Koch brothers are.
Mm-hmm.
But you were raising another issue area, a really important area, and that's about voter suppression.
Right.
There was a study by the Brennan Center, which is really respected as a pro-democracy center and nonpartisan, and it calls, it says that there was a margin of disenfranchisement, and they believe there was a higher number of people disenfranchised than the difference in votes overall. Now, part of what they're including are those who weren't allowed to vote because of previous criminal convictions, this whole issue of felony reenfranchisement, which is quite an important issue, people who've served their time, knowing that there's also a criminal justice system that unfairly targets people without resources, poor people, people of color, much more than others in the society. And then once they have served their time, aren't welcomed back to be in the company of citizens and with full citizen participation.
Mm-hmm.
But the Brennan Center says when you count in felony disenfranchisement, the impact of the Voting Rights Act not covering all the states it had before, and the voter ID laws, as well as various citizenship laws in different states, you're talking about a very high number of people who would have wanted to vote and weren't able to. Just to give you some sense of it, in Kansas, where documentary proof of citizenship is required, they estimate that 21,000 people tried to register and couldn't provide that evidence. It doesn't mean they weren't citizens. It means they just didn't have that documentation. There's a separate state voter ID in Kansas, and the Brennan Center estimates that 17,000 people were denied because they didn't have the voter ID. The difference in the governor's race, the very high-profile race, where Brownback was reelected as governor, was 33,000 votes.
So it was close enough to make a difference.
Close enough. In fact, it's more people were not allowed to vote than was the difference in the race. And I could give you just one more story on this. In Virginia, there's a woman named Virginia Whitaker. In fact, she's often called Miss Virginia. She's 93 years old. She taught English and science and civics for 36 years. She was denied the right to vote for the first time in her life because she didn't have a voter ID.
Mm-hmm.
She's 93. She no longer drives. She doesn't have a picture ID. She went several times to the election booth. She tried to show other forms of ID. They said she just couldn't vote. And she put in a great deal of effort to it. After all, she was a teacher herself of civics.
Mm-hmm.
But what about people who don't have the time, don't have the resources? I mean, it's almost going back to the days of when there was a poll tax for voting. In the civil rights movement, African Americans were often charged a tax, several dollars in order to vote when they were making so little income that it was a barrier that prevented many from voting. And again, the Brennan Center estimates that in some states, the cost of these IDs, when you count the filing fees for a birth certificate, the travel to go back and forth to get your identification, that it could be, they estimate, between $75 and over $100. So it really is going back to the disenfranchisement, even of the poll tax.
Right, and you mentioned how close that governor's race is. There was also the race with the U.S. Senator Kay Hagan, lost to a Republican by only 2 percentage points. It's entirely possible that's another race that could have been affected by this voter suppression effort that the Republicans have been pushing for years.
And there's been such protest in North Carolina about that with the Moral Monday movement, where between 80 and 100,000 people have joined in demonstrations there, and it's spreading across the South and even spreading around the country with this remarkable leader, Reverend Barber, who's head of the state conference of the NAACP, but joined by people out of congregations, faith community, Planned Parenthood, environmentalists, and other people of goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
Drawing attention to these voter ID laws and how, just as you said at the start of the program, we are all in it together.
Right, exactly. Well, it seems to me that this is the election where we actually felt the full force of the Republican strategy of the past, you know, at least 6 years, probably longer. The combination of voter suppression to keep mostly Democrats home, people with less income, less education, people of color, the younger people, all tend to vote pretty heavily Democratic. So there's the voter suppression initiatives that they've had, combined with the incredible amount of money. And there was some conversation before the election or during the election cycle about the amount of money unleashed by Citizens United, as you mentioned. You know, the limits are off. McCutcheon decision earlier this year, you know, more limits off of the money that rich people can spend. And unaccountable money. Like, we don't even know where some of this money comes from. But you're seeing hundreds of millions of dollars pouring into the elections. We don't even know who the donors of it are, and yet that amount of money can really impact an election, particularly a close election, and then combined with the Republican strategy of obstruction, where explicitly Mitch McConnell and other leading Republicans said that their goal was to deny President Obama any victories so he would have nothing to run on. Now, I'm actually amazed that President Obama did what he did in spite of their obstruction, the fact that he got the health care bill through so people can have health care now. That is an amazing achievement. And then he got reelected in 2012, because that was one of the explicit goals for the Republicans, was to deny Obama a second term. So he did succeed in doing that, but this... I've never seen anything like it, where it's deliberate strategy by the Republicans to just block anything happening in Congress, and yet somehow the Democrats got held responsible for it. And the, you know, what happened there? Did, why didn't the Democrats do more to expose what these the Republican strategies were?
Well, I do think it's some of it's running upstream, in that you've got Fox News, which is. So listen to, you know, it's on in almost every bar and every, I would give blood at the Red Cross, and it was on there, and I said,
no.
You want me to give blood, you've got to change this station. I don't want their lies out there. And, there, you know, there have been studies just showing that people who, that it's both the people attracted to listening to Fox News, but also from listening to Fox News, you get one source of information, and you believe there's no climate change. You believe that their climate change is not, you know, man-made contributing to it. You believe that there isn't really a civil rights concerns in this country, a criminal justice concerns. You believe, you know... just issue after issue, you develop a point of view that's more consistent with both a Republican and a right-wing agenda. So there is a question of getting the story out. But I also think we didn't have a bold narrative for which we were fighting in a unified campaign over a period of years. I do think the president has fought for and won things that really are significant, and I think we are about to see other things that may be as or more significant than almost any recent president. I mean, not only we got health care, you know, the Clintons had tried for it for a while, single-payer advocates had tried, still are trying for a long time, and we still need to go, in my view, toward a single-payer system. But it hasn't been successful. President Obama, with the forces of many people working around the country, were able to pass the health care bill, as you said. On financial reform, this president was able to lead the way. So there is a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. that is saving people money every day, though it's under enormous attack from the Republicans.
Right. It's our, that financial bureau has saved consumers billions of dollars already.
Exactly, though it's, as again, fights for its life every day.
Right.
And then just, was it yesterday or a couple of days ago, the president said he would support keeping a free Internet, not having a speeded up,
right,
paid for version on the Internet, and having an open Internet, which again was taking on some of the biggest corporate forces in the society and taking on Republican interests, and then making this initial arrangement with China on climate, much further to go, much further, but an important step. And we are told that within a fairly short period of time, at least he said before the end of the year, the president says that he will take action on immigration reform.
Yes.
On immigration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the situation there, and this is just so extremely important for democracy, for the economy, and for justice, for what's right in,
mm-hmm,
this country. There are 11 million people without documents in the country. The Senate passed a bipartisan bill over a year ago, Republican and Democratic support. It could have been a better bill, but it was a good bill. Probably covered maybe 8 million people, maybe a little more out of those 11 million. The bill then could have gone to the House, but John Boehner and the Republican leadership would not allow it to come to a vote. And we believe that had it come to a vote, we would have won that vote.
Mm-hmm.
So they wouldn't do that. And then the only things that the Republicans voted on related to immigration is they wanted to bring up defunding the young dreamers who are here, the children who were brought to this country by parents who were not documented, and they were not documented. But, you know, there's innocence in this country. And President Obama gave them a way to stay here with renewable, that's renewable every 2 years, but this DACA, this deferred action,
mm-hmm,
for these young people. And there are about 500,000 of them that have taken him up on that offer. So that's the backdrop, where the Republicans have opposed this at every point, and even for the DACA kids, the Dreamers, the one thing that they wanted to vote on was to defund that program. That was the immigration reform they offered before the election. So the president has now said he will take administrative action. Since the Republicans and Congress is not going to act, he will act on his own in full framework of what's allowed legally, administrative action for prosecutorial discretion, which means that, you know, it makes sense that the highest law enforcer in the country can decide, do you spend your time looking at someone who's jaywalking, or do you spend your time looking at someone who's, you know, part of some serious mafia ring? And the same thing on immigrants. For immigrants coming to this country, other than that they arrived here without documents, they're probably amongst the most law-abiding parts of the country in general, because they wouldn't want to be picked up by law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So why spend your time on checking to see if people have documents and checking to see if otherwise law-abiding people have a driver's license, which you can't get without a document? Why spend your time on that? And why not spend your law enforcement time on serious and violent crimes? And the president may take action and providing work permits for millions of people. Now, in response to that, Mitch McConnell and Karl Rove and others have said they will then block anything, any other legislation, any other judicial or executive appointment, if the president takes this action. But he would take it because people's lives are at stake, how they're treated, and because the Republicans have refused to act. So all of this is just a further indication of there's quite a record there. and a record, by the way, just to stay on this for another minute. I don't know if you want to comment before we move on, but it's important when this comes out for the public to first encourage the president to do this so that he does take action and it's not delayed. And when it does come out, to then be there to support it, because there will be a right-wing firestorm, even greater, we anticipate, than what was there around health care.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's great. And I want to acknowledge and honor you for the work that you've done to bring immigration reform to the place that it is. And I am excited that Obama is willing to do it. I was one of the ones hoping he would do it before the election.
Yes.
And I thought he might have inspired some more of the base to come out if he had. But anyway, that's water under the bridge at the moment. But I'm delighted he's willing to do it now. And, you know, with the Republicans threatening to block any bill if President Obama does an executive order on immigration reform, the question that comes to my mind is, how would we notice any difference from what the Republicans have been doing since Obama was elected? They have been threatening to block any bill. There's been, you know, bill after bill passed in the Senate, as you mentioned, happened in immigration, and then just died in the House because the Republicans control the House. And, you know, that happened with climate change bills, with all kinds of bills. So, you know, I think good for President Obama for having the guts to stand up, do it now, do what he can do with executive action. And he just had an historic agreement this week with China on climate change. So I'm hoping he'll be completely unleashed and do absolutely everything that he believes in for the remainder of the 2 years that he's got.
But, you know, it all depends on how we organize.
Absolutely.
It really depends on us.
Absolutely, it does. And I want to turn in 1 minute to, you know, what we progressives can do. And you've laid out one very specific strategy now, which is to encourage President Obama to do the executive action on immigration reform and then be very visibly in support of that for the inevitable Republican backlash. But one of the great shining lights of this campaign was the wonderful U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren from my home state of Massachusetts, who was the most popular Democrat on the campaign trail everywhere in red states and blue, with the message that you're talking about, taking on Wall Street, reducing student debt, expanding not only saving but expanding Social Security, and she was just bringing down the house wherever she went. So I am thrilled to have learned today, and this is the breaking news we mentioned at the beginning of the show, that just today Senator Warren announced she is joining the Senate leadership team as the strategic policy advisor to the Democratic Policy and Communications Committee, which means that Elizabeth Warren is going to be helping to shape the messaging and communications coming out of the Senate for the next couple of years. So just wanted to mention that to our listeners and see if you had any comment on that breaking news.
I think it is so exciting. You know, we worked together around the financial reform fight and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and she really is a heroine. And her taking on this role will allow us to promote more aggressively with a louder megaphone an economy that works for all of us and not just the wealthy, with the specifics, closing the corporate loopholes, stopping the offshoring of jobs and letting money into tax havens instead of investing in the country, ensuring that there are jobs, building bridges, repairing roads, developing the internet for all, jobs in early childhood education, home workers or green jobs, a women's economic agenda, expanding Social Security and Medicare, not cutting it, just as you said, making college affordable, addressing the issues of student debt. She's been a real leader on that.
Mm-hmm.
And addressing inequality in the economy to make sure that it works for all. So I was so excited about this And I do think that these and some other points are elements of a broad policy agenda that can be tied together with a shared story about who's causing the problems, about who's being harmed by it, and what we can do about it through organizing on an ongoing basis, not just during the elections, but for 2 years, 4 years, 10 years, and on into the future, and really sending the message that we have the power, but only if we organize.
Fantastic. And I want to congratulate you on the great work you did with Senator Warren on that, the Financial Bureau. And so do you have any inside scoop for us? Is there any chance that she'll run for president in 2016?
Well, she has said she is not. But she's also said you never say never. And I think that really what we need to do, and she would say this also, is it's on us. We need to organize
right
for those policies, for those messages, and to also take some of the future in our hand, local fights, statewide fights, building coalitions in the states, having all the groups come together, whether it's Planned Parenthood and NARAL, whether it's the statewide organizations like U.S. Action and Center for Community Change, whether it's the clean money organizations, a new group called One Voice is out there exposing how the money impacts almost every issue we work on, the environmental issues, and finding ways that all those groups with the unions work together. And really coming back to the union principle of solidarity, for the union makes us strong.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, it's interesting. As you know, I went up to Massachusetts and worked for Elizabeth Warren when she was running for the Senate. And when she had a wonderful party that she threw for all of us who work for her, and I talked to her at that event and congratulated her, and she was like, well, you know, thank you all for what you did. And she said, what we did here in Massachusetts, we need to do all across the country. And I think that's exactly right what you're saying. And this was a problem, I think, in 2008 when so many of us were excited about Obama running for president and we got him elected. And it was just one of the highlights of my life to see him elected by the people of the United States. And, you know, I think a lot of people said, oh, great, we succeeded in that, now let's go home. And, you know, that's just the beginning, really, is getting someone elected. It's that ongoing work of education and organizing that we all need to be doing on an ongoing basis in order
Absolutely.
To be able to elect people like Elizabeth Warren. So let's use our remaining time here on this interview to talk about what advice you have for, you know, we progressives. What specifically can our listeners do to help mitigate the damage of what the Republicans will do in Congress, because we know they're going to push for the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement that's very favorable to the corporation. They're already talking about pushing for the Keystone pipeline to be built, and my concern is the bipartisan approach that usually succeeds in Congress tends to be a pro-corporate agenda. So we have to mitigate that damage, stop that Trans-Pacific Partnership, and advance this program that you're talking about a more broadly shared prosperity in the economy. But what could we do, like for our listeners, what would be the top three things that we need to do now to advance progressive values and agenda in the United States?
Well, the most specific issue coming up, you mentioned the trade deal, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is really a dangerous allowing corporations to make decisions, not even countries to make decisions, and undermining democracy itself. The working for immigration reform, which is coming right up and will affect every other issue. But there's so many things. There are, you know, there are local issues. There's a decision coming down with Michael Brown in Ferguson, and there's concern about racial justice and the criminal justice system. But beyond all of the individual issues, and there are so many that matter, I think overall the worst legacy of this period, shown in the election, is the diminished hope people have
right.
that change is possible,
mm-hmm.
the diminished belief that they can make a difference, that together we can make a difference. And so I think perhaps the most important thing is that we do commit to a broad view to work for an economy that works for all of us and not just the wealthiest few, that we find ways, whether it's online or on the ground, in our local communities, with groups working nationally, that we work together on a shared vision with a shared message and shared agenda and join in for those activities that move us to a society where people feel there is hope for the future, build our movement, our unity, our confidence, and through that really rebuild our democracy.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Well, that's a beautiful note to end our program with. And Heather Booth, I want to thank you so much for all the great work that you do. Thank you.
Well, I thank you, Eleanor. You have been you've really been a shining star in this movement for so many years. I'm so glad to be a partner. I appreciate you letting me on the program. I appreciate those people listening in.
Wonderful.
And to continue the action you've been taking.
Wonderful, wonderful. More to come from both of us, I'm sure, and from all our listeners.
Thank you.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.